Hello, listeners. Yamina here. Welcome to the Dr. GPCR podcast. If you're watching or listening to the podcast on YouTube, you might be wondering, what am I doing in front of the camera? Well, the podcast, Dr. GPCR podcast, started 4 years ago, and I thought it was time for us to do something differently. Therefore, from now on, the introductions and outros of the podcast will be recorded with the camera on. Before we dive into this episode, I have a few announcements to make. First, I'd like to talk to you about the Dr. GPCR University that we launched in February of 2024. The goal is to provide courses and contents on all aspects of GPCR research to support you, our community. We kicked off the first course of the university by partnering with Dr. Terry Kanakian, who taught a class about applying pharmacology to drug discovery. The class was a great success. Mark your calendars for May 9th, as we are partnering with Dr. Sam Hoare, who will be building on the concepts taught by Dr. Kanakian and will be showing you how to analyze your data. The course is split up into four modules. The first module will be about analyzing concentration curve response data. The second one will be about analyzing agonist pharmacology data. The third one about antagonist pharmacology data. And the last one will be focusing on new dimensions of activity, including allosterism and kinetics. Learn how to handle allosteric modulator data, how to best analyze it and quantify activity in support of medicinal chemistry and target research. Please note that we are very excited to be offering 5 complimentary individual spots to anyone who'd like to join the course and lives in a developing country. This will be on a first come and first serve basis. And if you'd like to join Dr. Hoare's workshop on any of our next classes, we'll make a Google form available to you. I also want to take a moment to highlight that if you are in a developing country and you would like to access all the content in the ecosystem by getting a Dr. GPCR ecosystem premium plan, we do offer a 90% discount on this plan. If you'd like to take advantage of this offer, or if you are facing financial hardship and even with a 90% discount, you are unable to join us, we invite you to email us at hello@drgpcr.com. We are here to help. The second announcement I'd like to make is about the Endocrine and Metabolic GPCRs meeting. What are you doing April 22nd and 23rd? Join me and our GPCR colleagues for the inaugural edition of the Endocrine Metabolic GPCRs meeting taking place in the UK. This event will bring together scientists from both academia and industry to exchange data, technologies, and ideas in the field on GPC endocrine metabolic GPCRs. This meeting is organized by Bioscientifica and endorsed by the Society for Endocrinology. I'd like to say a special thank you to Professors Aileen Hanyalolu, Davide Calibero, Dr. Caroline Gorvin, Dr. Alejandra Tomas, and Professor Peter McCormick for putting together the scientific program of this very exciting meeting. The third announcement I'd like to make is for you to mark your calendar for this year's Dr. GPCR Symposia. This year, we're holding 3 events for which we have planned talks, poster presentations, and panel discussion. Anyone at any level working on GPCRs or related proteins is welcome to give a talk, as we aim to democratize our events. If you have a story that you'd like to share in the form of a poster presentation, you're also welcome to join us. It doesn't have to be a full story. It doesn't have to be a full poster. Just bring in a couple of slides that you can use as a visual aid to discuss your project with your peers and colleagues. March 15th this year was when we held the first Dr. GPCR symposium, and we talked about GPCR activation and signaling. It was a great success. We've had almost 100 people join us for the entire length of the conversations that we had and the talks that were presented. The next symposium, however, will be on June 7th and will be focusing on structural insights into GPCR activation. And then on October 11th, we'll dive deeply into GPCRs as therapeutic targets. If you'd like to join us, if you'd like to give a talk or present a poster at our event, please email us at hello@drgpcr.com. If you want to join us to these events are free. You just have to become a Dr. GPCR ecosystem free site member, and you'll be able to get access to the link to join the talks. And now let's dive into this episode. Hello, everyone. This is Yamina from Dr. GPCR. Today, I'm very excited to have with me Dr. Mike Fagan. Mike, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being here today. Very excited to talk to you. And how about we start at the beginning? Would you please introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what is it that you do?
Sure. Thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here. My name is Mike Fagan, and I am an associate professor of oncology at Roswell Park Cancer Center in the Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics. And I'm also the director of graduate studies for our experimental therapeutics track. And my lab is really focused on pancreatic cancer. Obviously, I study G protein coupled receptors for about half of my lab, and the other half works on gene regulation and RNA biology.
Interesting. What a combination. I'm very interested in hearing how do you met well how do you put those two together?
I don't, but we'll talk about that.
Fantastic. So what's your story as a scientist? Where did you go to graduate school? How did you end up being a professor?
So I did a lot of undergraduate work, and I actually started over the summer during college at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. And I was working in a lab there on small G proteins. And then when the summer was over, I met with the PI, and he was like, "Hey, do you want to do some work during the school year up at college?" I went to Cornell, and I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, let me contact my friend who also works on small G proteins." And so I worked in his lab for a year, doing more small G protein work, and then eventually spent the next couple of years working on Golgi dynamics and doing some cell biology. And when it came time to apply for grad school, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. I know I liked cell signaling, and working on G proteins was my biggest interest. And so I applied all over the place, got into different places. But then one day I got a phone call from a professor at SUNY Stony Brook on Long Island, and he looked at my CV and saw that I'd worked for all these G protein people, and said, "I want you to do your PhD in my lab." And I said, "Okay, that sounds good." So I went to Stony Brook and worked for Craig Malbon. And it turned out it was a really exciting time, because this was back when Wnt had not been purified. And so there was really no good way to study Wnt beta-catenin signaling, if you weren't using a model system, at least. And so what he had done was, since he was an expert in G protein coupled receptors, was this really cool technique where he people in his lab cloned essentially this receptor where the outside was the beta-adrenergic receptor and the inside was Frizzled. And so the thought was that you could then use agonists of the beta-adrenergic receptor, and then whatever happened inside the cell would be a Frizzle-dependent Wnt signal. And so they published, I think it was a Science paper in 2001, showing that in fact Frizzled was a G protein coupled receptor, and if you treated the cells with pertussis toxin, you could block this Wnt response. And so that's when I joined the lab, and my goal was to understand, what comes next, what is the G protein, and what are the G protein effectors that are there, and how do they modulate the signal leading to beta-catenin. That's what I tried to do. It didn't work, and it turned out that I couldn't get really any good results, and it was a nightmare for the beginning of my PhD. And so I started reading a lot about RGS proteins, and realized that maybe the best way was trying to understand if we could find an RGS protein, which is a negative regulator of the heterochimeric G proteins. A paper had just come out showing that these RGS proteins, in addition to negatively regulating G proteins, could also act as scaffold proteins. And I said, well, if we could find the RGS protein, we could understand what G protein is binding to and maybe what downstream component is binding to. And that's what my PhD turned into. I discovered an RGS protein that was involved in Wnt signaling that, when overexpressed or knocked down, blocked the Wnt beta-catenin signal. And that's how I got into studying GPCRs and G protein signaling. And then I left it for a while to get into my postdoc.
And how did you handle those difficulties in the beginning during your PhD? I mean, it's not a trivial thing. First, thank you for sharing that, because I think we don't share enough times all the failures or all the difficulties. And I don't like to call them failures. I think these are lessons learned. When your protein is trying to tell you something, and it's for you to listen in. But I'm curious how you handled it from an emotional standpoint.
probably not well, but I think I was I don't know. I think I thought that things should work, and the fact that things, because I hadn't done a lot of research before, and then I didn't realize that most of the time your hypothesis is not going to be right, and things are not going to work, and it's not going to be your fault, and also the model was very difficult to work with, and so I think my way around it was just to kind of like live in a fantasy world of what else can I do? And so I just read like 1,000 papers to try to say like, what could save me from this? What else can I do that I can, that can be my PhD? And so that is I think that's how I dealt with it, just kind of trying to think of alternate plans that I could do, and one of those alternate plans eventually worked out.
And I think that's, in my opinion, that's also the right way of going about it. I think once you realize that it's not you, it's not your hands, it's not the cells, it's not the stars that are misaligned, then it's time to get back to the science and try and figure out what else can you do. And if you can make your that project work, then there are other things, other questions that you could be asking.
Definitely.
But I think that dark period where, at least in I went through this as well, when nothing is working and you're wondering, is it you, or is it, what is going on? And then you have to really go back and do this inventory of what could have gone wrong, and did you do something wrong in the experiment? That's a nightmare to go through, but you have to, I think, as a PhD student, to go through those.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's, everybody goes through that, in year two or year three or something where nothing works. But then when I think when you're on the right track and, you're doing experiments to kind of just follow up on other things that work, more things work because you know what you're doing and you're on the right track. But before you kind of find that path, it's tough.
And then, so what made you decide to do a postdoc?
I really liked doing science, and I didn't really know what else to do. I guess I thought about industry a bunch, and I knew I wanted to stay on Long Island. My wife had just gotten a good job on Long Island, and so we had reason to stay there. There were some drug companies there, and I remember applying to one of them because I wasn't sure, and they said, do you have experience with this technique and this technique and this technique? And I said, oh my God, does anyone have experience with all those techniques? And so I don't know. I felt like I was woefully unprepared for anything. But I really liked the process of doing science and thinking about it, and I wanted to do a postdoc. And so I applied for postdocs as well, and got one. And I was kind of looking for someone who was so my mentor in grad school was older and was vice dean of research and was not in the lab, very often, was on sabbatical my last year there. And I said, I want someone, more hands-on, who's kind of around more. And so I was looking for a personality change and also looking for a research change. I'd done everything kind of in vitro at that point. I really wanted to start working with mouse models. I wanted to transition into cancer biology. And so that's why I kind of decided to go and do a postdoc at Cold Spring Harbor.
Where did the cancer biology aspect of it come from? I mean, as you mentioned, during your PhD, you've done a lot of in vitro and receptor engineering, and then looking at an art, quote unquote, an artificial system.
Yeah.
But where does the cancer biology come in?
So I've kind of always had an interest in cancer. I don't know why, but that was just kind of always what my interest was. And I think from my first experience as an undergraduate, even when I was working on, G proteins, it was on, how G proteins regulate SARC. And so all the pathways were all of these, oncogenic signaling pathways, but they were all in a dish. And I remember when I was in grad school, I had done all of this work showing that when you overexpress or when you knock down these different RGS proteins, you can impact beta-catenin's phosphorylation and ability to activate transcription and all this stuff. And I was so excited about it. And then my mentor said, you know, well, what's the phenotype? I said, I don't care. Like, I've altered signaling. That's all I want to do. And we had a cell line in the lab that was a stem cell like lab where essentially you can add some factors to it and it would cause the cells to differentiate. And then you could then stain them with a specific antibody. And we knew this to be Wnt dependent. And so that was our like assay for, you know, Wnt dependence. And so when I was doing that, I said, you know, if I really want to study cancer signaling pathways and know more about it, I have to use better models. And so that's why I went to a lab that was really focused on 3D biology using organoid models and mouse models. So I really just wanted to gain new techniques.
I love it. I like it because it's from what you're telling me, it looks like a natural evolution of, you know, being able to look at it in a dish, in a system, and then going into a model. Because at the end of the day, it can work very well in your hex cell.
Yep.
But then taking it into an animal model or a different system, that's a whole other story.
Yep.
As a child or maybe as a teenager, were you always attracted to science, or did you know that you're going to be on this science track?
Yes. There was no like moment I knew. It was just I've always liked science. It was like the one subject I was really good at. Especially biology, not good at math or physics or anything like that. I just like biology, and it was always just one of those things that I could understand. And I think I was in high school when I said I want to study pharmacology, and then but I don't know if I knew it. I don't know how I knew what pharmacology was. And then I ended up going to grad school for pharmacology, being in a pharmacology department. And I'm in a pharmacology department now. So I don't know. It's just kind of always been with me.
Interesting, because my next question was going to be, how did you know the word pharmacology? Because it's not an easy, you know, people think about biology, chemistry, physics, you name it, but then pharmacology is just a whole different world there.
Yeah, you know, I used to read a lot of like popular science books, and I must have read it in one of those. So at one point, I thought I wanted to be a virologist because I read, you know, books like Outbreak and Virus Hunters of the CDC and things like that. And so, you know, I thought I wanted to do that kind of work. And there was a time when I wanted to be, I think, a forensic toxicologist because I read a cool book about that. And so maybe that's what it was. Maybe it was that book. I learned the word pharmacology or something. But I still don't think I do pharmacology, but I've always been in a pharmacology department.
I love it. I love it. I also very much liked biology. I was good at math. I liked the comfort of math because you start off and then you drill down into your equation and then you get a number at the end. Physics was something that I could never understand. Chemistry, I tried to the best of my ability, but nothing. Mm-mm. Biology was the one subject that always spoke to me. It was just great. Just to look at it and, you know, being able to have a conversation with my high school, actually, biology teacher, and I really very much love the subject there.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, so you're finishing up your postdoc, you've switched topics and systems from your PhD to your postdoc, and then what? How did you decide which way to go?
Yeah, so actually, about it, year into my first postdoc, my mentor left Cold Spring Harbor and went to Toronto. And a contingent of us were able to stay back at Cold Spring Harbor. And so I stayed there. And that lab was actually really focused on cell polarity. And so I was looking at the role of cell polarity in cancer progression. And so this question of, like, you know, we know that cells are polarity in cells is completely disrupted in cancer, but is that a cause or consequence of cancer? And so I developed a mouse model that had a mutation in a cell polarity protein, and found that within the mammary gland, and found that the mice did eventually get tumors. And so it suggested that, you know, disrupting cell polarity by itself can really be a driver of tumorigenesis. And it certainly helps when you add an oncogene on top of that. And so I was doing that and I realized, I loved working in breast cancer, and I love, learning about the mouse models and doing the 3D modeling, which, because you had, you could never answer these questions in 2D. It had to be using 3D models. And so I really enjoyed that. But I really felt that I wanted to study G proteins again. And so at the time, you couldn't just go to like cBioPortal or something or the TCGA and just kind of like look up, your favorite gene and all these different cancers. Some of the data were available, but it was really, really hard to navigate. And so I just wanted to ask a question, which now seems silly, but back then it wasn't, done a lot. It was just like, what are the GPCRs that are highly expressed in triple negative breast cancer, for example? And so I ended up talking to Molly Hamill, who was a bioinformatics expert at Cold Spring Harbor. And she helped me, or actually she did the analysis and was able to pull out these lists of GPCRs that were highly expressed in triple negative breast cancer specifically. And I wanted to focus on that because there were no good drug targets. Mm-hmm. And I thought that finding a G protein coupled receptor that was highly upregulated in triple negative breast cancer could be a really interesting drug target. And so I think the one on the top of the list was GPR161. Almost nothing was known about this receptor, and I was really excited about it. And so I overexpressed it, knocked it out in our models, and discovered that overexpression drove proliferation, knocked down, stopped proliferation of these cancer cells, and figured out the pathway that it was, regulating, and published a paper on that. And it was really exciting because it kind of went from idea to the published paper in like a year, which was amazing. It happened really, really fast. And so that kind of really got me interested in, instead of, papers in the before times used to be like, I study kinases and I study this cancer. And then the last figure of the paper would be like, hey, we looked at like 10 samples that we happen to have, and like four of them are upregulated for our kinase that we found to be important. Therefore, we think it's important. But I really wanted to start from the other way and say, is this potentially important in humans? Now let's do the work to see if it actually is. And so that was the work I finished up and then changed to a second postdoc at Cold Spring Harbor with Dave Tuvison in pancreatic cancer. And because I didn't feel like I was ready for a faculty position at that time. And so I went to Dave's lab with the thought of really like getting a faculty position soon. And, I started to do this same thing of, use bioinformatics to pick G protein coupled receptors that were highly expressed within pancreatic cancer. But it turns out there are just not a lot of them. And so I started thinking more about this one question: why are genes dysregulated in cancer? And so one of the things that really confused me about GPR161 is that it's overexpressed in like 50% of patients that have triple negative breast cancer. And that's really rare because there are not a lot of things that are expressed in triple negative breast cancer among a lot of patients, which is why it's kind of, a disease of exclusion. And so I started thinking like, why are genes expressed? And then that led me to this question of gene dysregulation. And that became kind of now the other half of what I work on is different aspects of gene regulation and how they relate to cancer progression.
I love it. I think you're right. Early on, it was a difficult question to answer, to see, okay, what are the GPCRs that are expressed in some of these cancers? And the more specific you got, the least answers you would get. And it changed. I was at a conference last week about, it was a mostly industry conference. We had a couple of academics as well. It was the third targeted drug discovery summit, GPCR targeted drug discovery summit. And people are still asking these same questions, is what are the GPCRs that are expressed in cancer cells that are not expressed in normal cells? Or there's also this idea of treating tumors either with a vehicle or with an anti-PD or PD-L1, and then looking at how the gene expression changes and try to pick out the GPCRs that are for which the expression changes depending on this treatment to find the right targets. So it's not trivial. I think you're at the beginning of asking these questions.
Yeah, it's cool. And now that there's, just like you mentioned, there's so many other new data sets that are out there that you can answer these questions so much easier than before, but get more specific ones about resistance and about, you know, metastasis and stuff like that. And with single cell sequencing, you can find even, you know, more interesting things, although trying to find GPCRs in single cell sequencing is a nightmare.
It is. So you're doing the second postdoc and you're thinking about faculty positions. Why did you feel like you were not ready for a faculty position at the time? Or what were the questions that you were asking yourself that made you get to the conclusion of saying, well, actually, I feel like I need more training before going on solo?
Yeah, that's a good question. I felt like, you know, I had just kind of learned enough of 3D biology and mouse modeling, but I felt like, I don't know, I don't think, maybe I was ready, I just wasn't confident enough. But I felt like, you know, I had just finished like a second PhD almost, where, you know, now I'm getting these skills and I just didn't feel confident enough in them. I look back at it now, I'm like, you know, maybe I could have done it, but I also had, you know, I don't know if the papers that I published at that point were strong enough to get me a faculty job, and I was a little nervous about it. And so, you know, I'd also considered changing fields at that point to doing something completely different. But I felt like I really had this cool opportunity to stay and do another postdoc and be, it was right when Dave Tuveson's lab was moving back from England. And so there were a lot of new postdocs and I could be kind of like a senior postdoc in that lab. So it was a neat opportunity, and I liked Dave a lot, and I liked the way that he trained students, and I thought it would be really useful.
I like that, and I think there's nothing wrong with doing one or two postdocs as long as it's very well thought of, and also you know what you need from a training perspective.
Yep.
Or a confidence perspective, because you build that confidence over time. It doesn't come, you don't finish your PhD and then somebody delivers your diploma with a sigh of confidence there. And then, so you're finished with your second postdoc and then you're starting to look for faculty positions. I know that looking for faculty positions changes by, you know, by year, and it also depends on where you are in the world. But I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how did that go and how did you get ready for that that search?
Yeah, it was tough. It took a couple of years. And I think, yeah, so the first year I applied, I got an offer that ended up falling through for lots of political reasons at that first place that, you know, happens sometimes. But I think... you know, I was working on two really exciting projects that that finished up and got published. And I think that kind of really helped. We published a paper where I was one of the middle authors on developing a pancreatic organoid model. And that was really exciting because at that time, a lot of people were really interested in using organoid technology. And so I can say, oh, I can do that. I can, you know, bring that here and show everyone how to make organoids. And then the other was, you know, I was really excited about this other project I was working on, looking at non-coding mutations and how they might be drivers of gene expression in cancer. And so I worked really collaboratively with a bioinformatics PhD student, and that paper turned out to be really, really exciting. And I think that became a big high impact paper. And so that made me feel like I was kind of, my application would be looked at favorably, I thought at that point. And so that for me felt like I was ready. And I knew the environment I wanted to be in. I knew kind of what I wanted to do was combine, you know, this process where my lab would start with bioinformatics, move into in vitro models, and then use what we learned in vivo models, always trying to use, develop new therapeutics or find new targets and then hit them therapeutically. And so I knew I wanted to be in a pharmacology department, and there's not a ton of them. So I applied pretty much to like every pharmacology department I could think of. And, you know, that was, and then ended up here in Buffalo. And this is actually where my wife is from. And so it was really good because we were able to come to a place that, you know, we had family and a place that, you know, we both felt comfortable.
Yeah. And then now that you mentioned, I recently recorded a podcast with John Janetsko, who just got his faculty position, and he was in Brian yep. Kubilka's lab. And he was talking about the two-body problem, you know, because you're two people, you're looking for not one, but two positions. And that also factors into how you approach the job search, but also the fact that you need to get ready about a year before you're actually applying, because there is a lot of paperwork. There are things for you to think about. What are the projects you want to work on? What do you want to achieve? And discussions, you know, a thinking process that has to happen before you actually apply. Yeah. Was it similar to what you went through?
Yeah. I kind of had to think, you know, I did a lot of, you know, varied research in the past, and I had to think like, well, what am I now? And like, what do I want my lab to be? So there was a lot of that, like soul searching and saying like, you know, what am I, what's my lab going to be? What do I want to work on? What am I interested in? What are other people going to find interesting? Because I did not want to directly follow up my, you know, my big paper. We actually, before I left, one of the senior authors and I wrote a big grant about it, and it didn't get funded, but I think if it had gotten funded, it would have been a direct follow-up to that. And my life would be totally different now, because that's, you know, what I'd be working on. But I had to really think for a long time about what I wanted to do. And so, what I was able to do was kind of use some of that time to develop, some preliminary projects that involve G protein signaling within the context of pancreatic cancer, and get a bunch of prelim data that I was able to kind of put into my application package about, you know, things that I would follow up on when I had my own lab and what my first grants would be about and stuff like that. So, you know, I just got, you know, promoted pretty recently. And when I was giving my my talk about, you know, for my promotion, I said, you know, I hope nobody remembers what I talked about in my job talk, because I didn't do any of this stuff. And so it turns out I didn't do anything that I said I was going to do when I got here, because just I hired some really, really good people who had really good ideas, and we just kind of went in different ways. But yeah, so I had a plan, but it turns out it didn't matter.
Congratulations on the promotion. I think we have to acknowledge that, and because it's a big deal. It is a big deal. It's a lot of work, and it's a lot of people's work who you're responsible for. So congrats.
Thanks.
And I love it, because you're right. It's like this podcast episode. We have an outline, and we're going into a completely different direction. And I think it's with science as well. You may have a plan, but you thought about that plan. And when you hire people who are really, really good, it's you have to follow the science, and you have to follow up on those ideas. So yeah, how? Please go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No. Please, I think it's please.
Oh, what was I going to say? I think when I was a grad student and my stuff was not working out, and I went to my mentor and said, you know, I read this paper and I think this is the answer, these RGS proteins. He said, you know, give me a folder of every paper, print out every paper that's, you know, relevant, that involves RGS proteins and whatever signaling, and we'll talk about it. And, you know, I did, and I printed it out and gave him a binder, and he read it and he said, all right, let's do it. And so, you know, and it worked, which I think is good. But so now that, like, that, I think I did the same thing when I was a postdoc. the GPCR. I think I had this freedom because my postdoc mentor was, you know, in Canada and you know, yeah, couldn't see me working all the time. And certainly, you know, my second postdoc loved when people came up with their own required people to come up with their own ideas. Even on interviews would say, like, you know, come prepared with some crazy idea that tells us how you think. And so, you know, I've always had people who've encouraged, you know, thinking for yourself. And, you know, that's what I've always tried to have in my lab. There's people who come up with cool ideas. And then my job is to kind of like just direct them and make sure they don't work on 50 of these ideas at the same time.
I love it. That was going to be my question exactly, is how do you how do you make sure? Because it's a leadership style. It's not everybody's like that. There's some PIs who come in and say, this is your project, go ahead. Mm-hmm. That might fit some trainees, but there is another style like yours where you say, here are the limits, because this is what the lab is working on, and find your place in that. And I'll be here to guide you towards that. And if you find something interesting, of course, we're going to do it.
So I think I have, so what I've done for each of the people in my lab when they join the lab, you know, for the grad students and postdocs, is like, I sit down myself and I write up like a page of ideas. And it's like crazy ideas that I had, or tools that we have that no one's used yet, or, you know, obvious follow-ups to things that we've published. And every single time the people have been like, okay, I, you know, thank you for giving me this, but I want to do something else. And it's frustrating, but I think it's been really cool because it's led to some really, really interesting new things that I, you know, had never thought of before. And so, yeah, I like it that way. But I think if I ever had somebody who listened to me, that would be fine too.
No, absolutely. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I think to your point, during your one of your postdocs, you had mentioned where you had two projects where you were working on two things. And I think it's okay. I think it's even better because you get to collaborate within your own team, or you get to collaborate with others outside. And it's extra questions you can ask, but also extra publications at the end of the day.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk a little bit about the actual research, the two beacons of research that you do in your lab. And how did I do understand where those two came from, mm-hmm, but how do you manage the two projects? First, I'm interested in learning a little bit about whatever you can tell us about each, and how do you manage? It's like you have two mics or two brain positions there.
Yeah. So I think one of the good things is, you know, I don't disconnect them. I think everyone in my lab works together and knows what everyone else is doing. We have a Monday morning roundtable where everyone talks about their projects and says, like, this is what I did last week, this is what I'm doing this week, this is, you know, issues I'm having or whatever. So everyone has input in everyone's project, and it's not like, you know, team RNA and team GPCR. It's all, you know, it's all pancreatic cancer people. Although we might do some other cancers now, but so that's one thing. Like, I try to keep everybody together, so we're one lab. And so I don't know. I think all the techniques we use are very similar. Like, we're looking at the effect of certain GPCR targeted drugs on cancer associated fibroblasts. And right now we have a really big program of looking at gene regulation in fibroblasts. So I'll tell you about the two things that we're doing. When I was a postdoc, I was interested in looking at these non-coding mutations in promoters that were driving changes in gene expression in cancer. And we did that by looking through whole genome sequencing, publicly available whole genome sequencing efforts, and then correlating mutations with changes in gene expression of those genes in patients, then looking specifically at, like, were those mutations in binding sites of transcription factors and things like that. And so my first postdoc came, and she was really interested in developing her computational skills to go along with the wet bench skills that she had from her PhD. And so we became really interested in looking at, I gave her a bunch of things that I thought would be interesting. but she said, you know, I'm really interested in looking at the 3' UTR because that's, you know, it's where all the microRNA is bind and it's really important for gene regulation. And I said, sounds great. Let's look for mutations in 3' UTRs and see if this is like common. And she did that for a little while and didn't find anything super interesting. And then said, well, you know what? There's this process called alternative polyadenylation, which essentially determines the length of the 3' UTR. And in cancer, 3' UTRs are generally shorter in most genes. And so they lose kind of all of that regulatory space that should be binding to microRNAs or RNA binding proteins. And so this is one of the ways that cells can keep maintain the stability of RNAs that are important for tumor growth. And so that this process of alternative polyadenylation, she kind of did these the first single cancer study of alternative polyadenylation in cancer and found all this really cool stuff. And that became like now the whole focus of this side of the lab. So we have a drug that now targets an enzyme in the enzyme that actually cleaves the mRNA called CPSF3. And so when we treat our cancer cells with this drug, it stops them from growing, also stops their ability to migrate and invade. And so we're trying to understand the genes that are dysregulated there. And then when we actually put it on cancer-associated fibroblasts, they completely change as well. And their metabolism also completely changes. And so we're trying to understand how this process also controls metabolism. I'm not a metabolism person. So that's been like really interesting. And so that's kind of how like, you know, this one idea the postdoc had has turned into a whole bunch of papers and, you know, the work of another postdoc and a grad student and a couple of other people in the lab as well.
That's really, really cool. That was going to be my question is you've identified this enzyme, but what does it do typically in a normal setting? And if you're thinking about therapies, how are you going to deliver the molecule or any molecule to target this enzyme and only target cancer cells?
Yeah. So it's interesting because so this enzyme not only cleaves the polyadenylated mRNAs, but it also cleaves the non-polyadenylated replication-dependent histones. And so, yeah, it took me a while to like get all that wording right. And so, you know, some histones are polyadenylated and the ones that are really important for the cell cycle are not polyadenylated and they get cleaved by this other complex called the HCC. And CPSF3 is the enzyme in there. And it turns out that for cells that are rapidly proliferating like cancer cells, kind of like the first thing that they notice, it seems, is when you mess up with the when you mess up the processing of their histones. And so what we find is that essentially the faster a cell proliferates, the more sensitive it is to this drug called JTE-607. And so even slower growing cancer cells are less sensitive to this drug.
Okay.
But what we found is that there are, and so when we've tested the drug on normal cells, and they just keep cycling their cell cycle nice and slowly like they were doing before. They don't really seem to care. They don't have these defects in chromatin that we see when we treat the cancer cells. So there seems to be some therapeutic index there. And in fact, this drug was discovered about 20, 25 years ago as a cytokine synthesis inhibitor, but no one knew the target of the drug. And so it had been in like animal studies, there have been human studies of this drug, even though no one knew the direct target, and it does not kill people, despite the fact that like this is a process that is going on all the time in our cells. And so we know that you can inhibit, you know, this polyadenylation process, and you're fine, and it'll probably kill cancer cells more. And now what we're trying to do is make this a better drug, but also try to understand kind of what, besides the cell cycle, what makes cells kind of resistant to this. And we think it involves rerouting of kinase signaling pathways. And so now we have a whole bunch of combination therapies that really work a lot better than this drug alone or the kinase inhibitors themselves alone.
I love it. Very, very cool. All right, so this is the mRNA part of the lab. What about the GPCR?
Sure. So the GPCR side of the lab started with just that simple question of, can we knock out all the GPCRs and see if it has any effect on tumor growth. And so back before I left Cold Spring Harbor, I got a guide RNA library from Chris Vakich, who had kind of developed all these different guide RNA libraries to use CRISPR to knock out, you know, all the GPCRs. So I have this library. And the first thing we did when I got here was collaborated with Todd Ridke's group at UPenn and took that library, put it into melanoma cells, took those melanoma cells, put them into mice, let the tumors grow, and just said, you know, what were the guides that were either overrepresented or underrepresented, you know, when the tumors got big. And so we found a whole bunch of putative tumor suppressors and oncogenes in melanoma in this way. And so that was a paper that was published, I think, 2 years ago now. But that was kind of how I thought we would discover all these new things. But nobody in my lab has now has decided to use that library again in the context of pancreatic cancer. And so one of the things that that we had at Roswell was a that's now a little bit different. Was our qualifying exam was an exam where the student would kind of go away for like 4 or 5 months and just come up with a whole new project. And it could be kind of, you know, on the general scope of what they're working on in the lab, but it could not be, you know, directly related to their project. It could not be the project that, you know, they had already talked about with their mentor. And so my first grad student, Abby Cornwell, went away and like refused to talk to me for months. Like, you know, I would say hi to her and she'd be like, oh, I don't think I can say hi back. That'll break the rules. And so she came up with this really, really cool idea that now we're following up on a lot. And so essentially what it is, you know, we know that GPCRs are, you know, the best drug targets. And we know that, you know, 40% of all drugs that people take target G protein coupled receptors. And so, you know, I've known for a long time that, you know, there are lots of GPCRs that I think are should be targeted in cancer. But she, you know, thought about it a little bit differently and realized that, you know, cancer patients are taking lots of drugs. You know, they get chemotherapy, they get immunotherapy, but patients are also suffering from anxiety and depression and pain and stuff like that. Things that are associated with their cancer, associated with side effects of their treatments. And these are also treated with lots of drugs. But nobody ever considers the effects of those drugs on the tumor, despite the fact that, you know, we know that GPCRs are really, really important. And so, you know, what Abby realized was that there was an opportunity here. And so she realized that lots of pancreatic cancer patients take anti-anxiety drugs, that they're actually prescribed for nausea. And she had also realized that a paper had come out showing that there's a GPCR called GPR68 that's highly expressed on cancer-associated fibroblasts and is really important for fibroblast function. And furthermore, that a group had just shown that certain anti-anxiety drugs like lorazepam could be positive allosteric modulators of GPR68. So she kind of put this all together and said like, oh, wow, maybe patients taking anti-anxiety drugs are actually activating GPR68 on their cancer-associated fibroblasts, leading to problems. And so she put this all together. And then when she defended her qualifying exam and passed, I finally got to see what it was. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, let's do it. And so this became her project. And so we worked with epidemiologists who were able to look at the association between patients taking anti-anxiety drugs and patients taking not anti-anxiety drugs and outcome. And it turns out that patients taking lorazepam do much worse than patients taking alprazolam. And so it's not just, you know, am I taking an anti-anxiety drug? It's which one are you taking? And patients not taking any are right in the middle. And so lorazepam's bad, alprazolam's good. At least in, you know, the cohort that we were looking at, once we, you know, balance the groups for, you know, gender and stage and all that other stuff. Yeah. So then Abby took the, lorazepam and put it into mice. And we found that the, in those mice that were treated with lorazepam, there was a huge increase in desmoplasia. And so it looked like the cancer associated fibroblasts were highly activated and were spitting out IL-6 and we're spitting out collagen. things that we know to be associated with poor response to chemotherapy. So again, it matched the clinical data that we saw. And then she went in vitro and found, in fact, it was working how she thought, that lorazepam was activating GPR68, which is an acid sensing receptor. And so it's only active at low pH. So if you treat the cells at normal pH, nothing happens. If you treat them at low pH with lorazepam, you increase IL-6. And that is what we think is kind of driving this pro-fibrotic, pro-inflammatory response. And so that became this idea. And now we're following up on this with other anti-anxiety drugs and with other drugs that patients take a lot in the context of pancreatic cancer.
I think it's really, really cool. And I was just going to say that GPR68 is a proton sensing GPCR anyway. And in the tumor microenvironment, pH is lower.
Yep.
I think it's 6.5, not 7 point something. So,
yep.
But to get to the fact that it's a positive allosteric modulator, I think it's really, really neat.
Yeah.
It's a really neat story. I'm very much looking forward to seeing what other anti-anxiety medications do, because you're right, we don't think about these things.
Yeah. So we've now been focused. So, you know, it was funny trying to get money to fund this. Everyone's like, well, don't focus on lorazepam, it's bad. You know, focus on the good one, which is alprazolam. And so now we're focused heavily on alprazolam and trying to understand how alprazolam, what Abby found, which is kind of unexpected, is that alprazolam potently decreases IL-6 and does not have these effects in the tumor microenvironment. And, you know, IL-6 seems to be bad for reasons that no one really fully understands. And so IL-6 goes down when you treat calves with alprazolam. It's totally independent of pH, totally independent of GPR68. So it's not involving them at all. And so I have a new postdoc in the lab, Hunter, who's now following up on this. And I think she's discovered the GPCR that it works through. And we're trying to now follow up on this because we think that there's going to be lots of opportunities for modulating the tumor microenvironment, maybe even looking at changes in the tumor immune system.
Love it. I think this is really cool. You're at the forefront of last week's conference. We had a couple of talks that exactly dealt with this, really figuring out what are the GPCRs expressed not only on the tumor, but in the tumor microenvironment, and how can we modulate those to actually stimulate the immune system and allow the immune system to actually come into that environment and destroy the cancer. So
yeah,
really into very relevant work there. I ask this from everyone. Do you have a favorite GPCR?
Right now it's GPR68, but I think GPR161 is still my favorite. Because, you know, I still remember, you know, when I did that, I had people telling me like, you can't do this, it's never going to work. And then for some reason I picking it off the list. And I think there was, you know, KM plotter was around back then where you could kind of like type in your gene and look at it in breast cancer. And once I saw that there was this association between GPR161 and patient outcome, I was like, man, this thing's highly expressed. It, you know, yeah. Patients that have higher levels of it do worse. Maybe there's something here. And it was true. And, you know, I went to I remember going to a conference in Boston right after I published that paper and had a poster there. And there were, you know, lots of drug company people there, and they all came up, and, you know, there were so many people that were coming up that were excited about it. And now I've seen it on like lists of drug targets. So I feel like, you know, maybe someday there'll be a GPR161 inhibitor that will be used in triple negative breast cancer. And to me, that's still pretty cool.
I love it. And do you know, since it's an orphan, do you know what the natural ligand is? I'm not familiar with GPR161.
I honestly have not followed up on it, so I don't remember.
I'm just curious.
I know it's regulated by hedgehog signaling, or there's a connection with hedgehog that's really, really interesting, that kind of changes the localization of the receptor away from primary cilia. Okay. But yeah, I haven't followed up in a couple of years.
Okay. Wow. Interesting. So it must be in the in the family of I want to say very interesting GPCR, not your classical GPCRs. I think at this point it's smoothened that I had that pops into my into mind where you have this localized signaling in the primary cilia as well.
Yep.
Really, really cool. So obviously the question of do you think GPCRs are still good drug targets? The answer is pretty much yes.
I think so.
From a methodology perspective, from a technique perspective in your lab, what do you think is missing or what don't we know how to do yet in order to advance your projects? If you had a magic wand and you can come up with some way of getting more information out of the assays that you run, what would that look like?
I'd have good antibodies to any GPCR. That would be my yes. dream. I feel like, you know, we're at such a loss. I feel like they're not expressed at high levels. And so even when you do like qPCR, it's a pain. Western blots are a nightmare. And so when we're trying to look at localization, you know, in tissues, you know, I know there are different ways that you can label things like when you're looking in cells, but we're frequently looking in pancreas tissue, which is, you know, also a disaster because you have lots of enzymes there that destroy things. So us, it becomes a real big problem of trying to localize these things. So yeah. We've done some work using like, you know, RNA scope where we can see, you know, where the RNA is expressed at least. But I think having better tools to look in tissues for GPCR localization would be huge for us.
Yeah, and I think for the entire GPCR community, being able to, in a way, stay away from the hex cell model and being able to localize where your receptor is in a tissue is absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
Super. All right, so let's inspire some young scientists. How about you tell us if you can, what are the top three aha moments that you had as a scientist that shaped your trajectory? I think it came through the discussion in the past hour, but I'm curious if you can list them up.
Sure. Yeah. So my first one was definitely when I was a grad student and, you know, I'd read that paper. Kirill Martynyanov was the first author of that one. And it was, I think, affinity adapters, RGS proteins as affinity adapters or something like that. And I've sat next to him, but I've been too nervous to tell him how much that paper changed my life.
Well, maybe now you can listen on it on the podcast.
Yeah. So that paper, I think, was one of those moments. And then I remember when I was, you know, but even though I thought RGS proteins might be involved, I still didn't know, you know, until we actually did it, because, you know, a lot of people didn't believe. Probably still don't believe that Frizzled is a G protein coupled receptor. And anytime you see a, you know, a Wnt pathway, there's never a G protein there. But what I did is I took our model system and I think I did a PCR of every member of the RGS family to see which RGS proteins were even there. And then I cloned all of those and overexpressed them and then did an assay looking at beta-catenin activation. And when I looked at RGS-19, when I overexpressed RGS-19, beta-catenin activity went down. And I was like, but all the other ones didn't. And you know, I was amazed because I was like, you know, these things are supposed to be kind of like promiscuous. We knew a lot less about them then, but I was like, you know, but RGS-19 worked and none of the other ones did. And you know, when you look at the paper, it's just like it just goes down and nothing else matters. And I was like, oh my God, like this works. And I repeated that experiment, like, I don't know, 400 times or something, you know, repeating it and then did dose responses and then did time courses. And I remember one time I did a 48-hour time course, you know, just to kind of see what happened. And all the activity happened when I did the assay in the end. It turned out all the activity happened within like the first hour. And then it was stable all throughout there. So I spent 2 days in the lab for no reason. but it was fine because like that was it. So that told me that like I could think of an idea and you know, I could be right, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
After nothing else working.
And you get to follow up on it and you prove to yourself that what you've seen is actually true.
Yeah. So that was awesome. The other one was GPR 161 when I, you know, finally did that first assay and, you know, I overexpressed GPR 161 in these mammary epithelial cells. And normally they have like, you know, this nice, just like circular acinar structure. And then the ones that expressed GPR 161 had this like multi-acinar structure that looked all crazy, looked just like, you know, just like ERBB2 activation. I was like, wow, like this is real. Like, you know, I was able to go from just kind of a name on a list to something like that, which I thought was pretty cool. And so then the third one was probably when Abby showed me the data after she'd treated mice with lorazepam. And then when you look at the what the tumors look like, and she treated them with, when she stained for collagen, and like the whole slide like turned blue. Which was the color of the collagen deposition. And it's, up my wall over there. Abby printed out a picture for me. And like, I was like, oh my God, like this is real. Like this is actually happening. Because before that it was just a lot of like, you know, rationale that maybe is true, or a lot of like correlative work. But seeing it in the mouse model of pancreatic cancer, I think really, told me, that this is a real thing. And, you know, it's pretty cool. I used to like, you know, being at the X-ray film machine and like holding up the Western blot and like seeing the things for the first time. Yeah. I don't get that anymore since I don't do any experiments, but like, it's still cool. And people come to my lab and just like you could tell, like they just came from the machine, or Abby in this case said, like, she slacked me and said like, Mike, get over here to the microscope right now. And we just, she was like, all right, this is the control and this is the other one. And I was like, those are probably the most exciting so far.
I love it. I think the GPR 68 project, and it's something that people maybe don't think about when patients get all sorts of drugs in them, and then you have the drug interaction, and you would have thought, you know, you're trying to help with the mood or with the side effect, and then you're actually being harmful towards the for the patient.
I just gave a talk to a bunch of doctors about this, and they were like, oh, we give this stuff to everybody. But it's great to talk to them because they say, well, you know, you can't just give everybody alprazolam because they're, you know, real addiction issues associated with that. So it's been really, really informative for me to kind of for the first time I'm talking to palliative care doctors and things like that to really understand why these drugs are given and if there could be, you know, alternatives.
Yeah. Have you looked into dosage with the lorazepam? Is there, or length of treatment? Is there any correlation, or does it get worse the more you give, the longer?
That's a great question. We can't, we have not looked at that yet. The way these drugs are prescribed and taken is all over the place. And so it's extremely difficult to quantify. Other drugs like opioids, which are, you know, there's better records kept for those things, and, you know, dose equivalents and things like that. We're starting to do some of those things, but for the benzos, it's been really hard.
Wow. I'm just wondering, I think it would be a really neat experiment, at least in a mouse model, where you could play around with it, and also taking that out of the system and looking at some more of a biosensor based assay, where you can look at the dose response curves based on having different doses of the lorazepam. It's an allosteric modulator, so that could be a really cool experiment as well. All right, any advice or any other advice for junior scientists who want to contribute to the field?
Yeah, I would say, work on something that like you're really interested in. You know, I've seen a lot of advice that says like, you know, the mentor is more important than the project or something. And I think there's something to that. Like you should try to find a good mentor, who's, you know, gonna help you stay motivated or whatever. But, I don't know. I think that if you're working on kind of your own project that you develop, and you are totally invested in it, it makes all of the bad stuff easier to deal with, like, you know, grant rejections and experiments that don't work and hypotheses being wrong and stuff like that. So I don't know. For me, I've always found that like when I was working on my own stuff, feeling like I own the project, or it was like, you know, even if it wasn't my idea, I felt like I was the one helping to drive it, you know, for grad students who were just starting, like I was able to provide insight. And I think if you find a project like that, or a mentor that can help you develop a project like that, it just makes everything easier.
I agree, especially when you feel, for me, when it happened, it was towards the end of my PhD, because before then I did a master's, you're learning how to pipette and not make gels with water. That's one thing. And then when you get into a PhD, you kind of know what you're doing. But in my case, towards the end of my PhD, that's when I started thinking about more questions. And we had a project where I was like, wait a minute, why are we taking the project in this direction when there is a ton of papers that take you into a different direction? And that's when I said, well, wait a minute, can I do this? Let's do this. Mm-hmm. And I ended up taking the project in a completely different direction. And that's when I felt ownership. You know, it's my idea. And you're right, it doesn't have to be your idea, but I think what you bring to it matters. And the fact that you get to take that into the direction where you think the science is taking you and the data is thinking it's taking you, it gives you the sense of ownership and the sense of, you know, full investment, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, because it's your baby at that point.
Definitely.
No, I think that's great advice. All right, last question. If you could go back in time and give yourself advice, when would you go back to, and what would be the advice?
I don't want to put this on a podcast. Oh, that's a great question. I think I spent a lot of time when I started my first postdoc not being focused. And I probably could have done a better job of focusing and really thinking more closely about what I should be working on. I kind of had a personal experience that happened that kind of so one of my high school friends died when I was a postdoc of cancer. And I was when I was doing my first postdoc, and that really made me sit up and think and say, like, what am I doing? Like, am I doing the work that I think will lead to a cure for cancer, or to make people's lives better for cancer? And I really liked working on cell polarity. I thought it was interesting, but I did not see it as a way that I was going to change anything about how patients were treated. And so, but it took that experience for me to just say, like, you know, to re-examine things. And I don't know, maybe I could have said, like, hey, why are you going to this lab to do this specific experiment or to do this, learn these techniques, instead of a lab where maybe you could work on more translational science? But I think I needed to figure that out for myself over time, what I really liked. And I had really good experiences in that lab and, you know, a good mentor. But you know, I think focusing more translationally for me and probably would have gotten things done a little bit faster. So that's probably what I go back to and just say, like, think about what you're doing here.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think it makes a lot of sense. And no, I think as soon as you figure out why you're doing what you're doing, it allows you to think about which way to go to get there, or to really always keep that in mind and know, no matter what you do, it always gets you closer to the why.
Yep.
That you set out for yourself. And I think, and you're right, you have to make mistakes. And, you know, when you think about a postdoc, it's even if it's 5 years, it's short. It flies by, even a PhD. So very early on, thinking about these things, and it's not something that you plan, at least not for me, where you sit down, you say, oh, Monday morning, 8 to 10, I'm going to think about everything I want to do and why I want to do it. And then it's problem solved. It's an iterative process, and having a good support system having a good mentor, being able to have these conversations definitely helps solidify that why and the directionality that you want to take.
Yeah, I think I was lucky where, you know, when this happened and I really sat down with my mentor and I was like, you know, I like doing this. I need to do more. I want to focus on GPCRs again. This is what I want to do. And he gave me free rein to like do that stuff. And that's how the whole, you know, GPR 161. And now I think, you know, most of what I do is, you know, half of what I do is directly still from that initial idea, because I had a good mentor who would kind of give me that freedom.
I love it. Last but not least, if and when you have job positions open in your lab, how can people find you?
Probably Twitter is the best way. Yeah, that's yeah, I would say that's the best way to find me. I'm always posting stuff on there.
I know that's where I actually got to e-meet you on Twitter.
Yep.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for your time. I thought it was a really awesome discussion. I hope you had a good time. Don't go anywhere. We can let people wonder what we're talking about after we stop recording.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Can I ask you a favor? Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Many of you come back to watch our videos but aren't subscribed. Having more subscribers will help us get you more content. Also, mark your calendars and join me and your GPCR colleagues for the inaugural Endocrine Metabolic GPCRs conference taking place in the UK on April 22nd and 23rd. You'll be able to find more details about the event on the Dr. GPCR ecosystem under the events page. Thank you for joining us and listening to this Dr. GPCR podcast episode. We would like to thank our guests, our Dr. GPCR team, Attila, Ines, Montserrat, Ivana, Andreina, and Balint. If you like our podcast, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can also leave us a testimonial at drgpcr.com and subscribe today to our monthly newsletter. If you're part of the ecosystem, which we encourage you to do, it's free to join us. You'll be getting a weekly email about GPCR news. If you want to know what are the latest papers that were published, what are the latest accomplishments of your colleagues, what are the industry news in the GPCR field, and what are the job opportunities in the GPCR field, please do join us in the ecosystem. Another great way to support us is to share your favorite program with your network and colleagues. With any questions or suggestions, please email us at hello@drgpcr.com. Until next time, stay safe.